Welcome to this week's Tribcast on TexasTribune.org. I am Texas radio giant Scott Braddock, the state capital chief for the Texas State Networks and CBS Radio based out of Dallas. And now I have moved to Austin to join these folks for the Tribcast. And here's your host, Reeve Hamilton.
Thank you, Scott. I'm reporter Reeve Hamilton here with managing editor Ross Ramsey.
Howdy.
Ben Philpott of KUT in the Texas Tribune.
You moved to Austin just for the Tribcast?
Just for this.
And Scott Braddock.
Hey, I'm back. I'm back already. Didn't I just do the intro?
That's right. It's our first in-house celebrity intro. Very exciting.
Our own personal Don Pardo.
That's right.
Yeah, I've heard some of the ones on the phone. Those the audio could be a little better.
Your tone said it all there.
Yeah. Well, I told Matt Makoviak the other day that I was going to give him grief here on the podcast for his celebrity intro. But I liked when you called him Eminem.
Very good. We are going to, of course, talk about the earthquake that hit the East Coast. And that's about it. We're going to fill up our whole half hour that way.
I think just like CNN.
Nothing else has happened. But when we're done talking about that, we'll probably talk about Michael McCall, Eggheads, and Ron Paul. Sort of a little poem there. Let's start with Michael McCall, who might be getting into the U.S. Senate race.
This is one of those deals. You say, we hear that Mike McCall is talking to people about this race. What do you say? And you talk to his staff, and you say that, and they say, he is very interested in Texas having the best candidate. It's like, wait a minute, I asked you if he was getting in or not.
Yes,
we're very
or no.
interested in him having in us having the best candidate. So I guess Texas is interested in that too, but we still don't know definitively that he's interested.
Does he think his opponents are not interested in
it? It's a way of saying that, you know, I'm looking at it.
I want to point out that back in January on a podcast, I said that I thought Michael McCall would be a dark horse for the Senate race and would get in. Just want to say point that out.
Yeah.
Too bad Evan's not here.
Because nobody remembered it.
Exactly. Too bad Evan's not here. He'll continue to think I'm an idiot. I had a conversation with him right end of January after they did that. It was actually the night that they did that bipartisan State of the Union address where they had the congressman mix it up and have to sit beside someone from the other party. And I just thought he sounded like someone who was running for Senate on that 10-minute interview I did with him.
And you sound like somebody who's trying to win a bet.
I did say.
It's too bad you
I've already won my Perry running for president bet, so now I'm jumping in on this one.
It's too bad you've expended all your luck this year already. It's only August.
He's an interesting candidate. You know, he is, Roll Call magazine just called him the richest member of Congress. He's actually married to someone who made him the richest member of Congress.
Well, the daughter of Lowry, Clear Channel.
Right, Lowry Mays.
Clear Channel Communications, biggest radio company in America. 1,200 radio stations.
Are you a Clear Channel employee?
No.
I don't remember what Texas Networks was. I'm just asking, honestly.
So I can speak.
It wasn't a gotcha, I promise.
I'm actually allowed to talk about this. He married into that wealth, and so I think, you know, I mean, if we're talking about a Senate race that's going to be big-time money, and of course it is, you know, he's one of those guys who could be a real contender.
Right, yeah. I mean, you know, the point here being that, you know, he, like Dewhurst, could self-finance. You don't have to raise $2,500 a pop increments, and you could get into a race very quickly. Dewhurst starts with the name ID, but if you have enough money, you can buy name ID. If Mike McCall were to get in and were to devote some of his money, he's supposedly telling supporters he would put in $4 to $6 million, which is a start. It's not a full Senate race, but it's a start.
How is his
this
name
could be
ID?
Really interesting. Sorry?
How is the McCall name ID?
It's probably not very high. I mean, he represents 1/32nd of Texas. Right, he's one of 32 members of Congress. So he hadn't run in Dallas. He's only run peripherally in Houston. He has a district that stretches from Austin to Houston. So he's been in those media markets to some extent. But most people, particularly urban Texans, can't name their member of Congress. That's, anyway.
Yeah, they know who he is in Brenham.
Right.
So
we know what. Well, we know what Dewhurst. I mean, so what kind of a candidate would he be? I mean, he seems like he doesn't have the baggage of Dewhurst, but he seems more like an establishment candidate than Ted Cruz, obviously. So where does he kind of fit in the mix?
He's won election. He's been in public life for a while. He was an assistant U.S. prosecutor. He worked in the AG's office under John Cornyn when Cornyn was there. So he knows that world a little bit. He's been around politics a lot. You know, and when you get into a race like this, it's going to be which part of the Republican Party is each of these candidates appealing to. As it stands now, Dewhurst kind of starts as the traditional Republican candidate.
Yeah.
Ted Cruz is trying to shave off, you know, as many Tea Party votes and as much of, you know, that wing of the party, the insurgent or the dissident wing, whatever you want to call it,
so
as he can.
McCall? So he seems to be a little bit more leaning towards Dewhurst, but not, you know, he doesn't have the record of what some Tea Party people would say messing up things in Texas.
He's been a pretty conservative vote in Congress. So, you know, I think he probably makes an appeal to, you know, try to straddle those two things. And he's got the money to kind of sink the message. So, It could be interesting.
So who's more worried about it, Ted Cruz or David Dewhurst? Or the other candidates?
Sorry, yes, there are other.
Or anybody else.
You know, we've talked about this. I mean, you know, this race starts with a, you know, presumed winner, right? Mm-hmm. You have a lieutenant governor who's rich, and and there's not a particular, you know, there's some things that some people don't like. There's a little bit of sand, but for the most part, there's not a particular scandal or something that everybody goes, oh, yeah, but he's the guy who blah, blah, blah. So Dewhurst starts as the guy to beat. Now you've got another guy who matches him in money, who's also an office holder. That would be kind of interesting. The question for Ted Cruz and everybody else is, can I raise enough money to catch up with these guys?
And Ted Cruz has been racking up endorsements for weeks, and he's been going to Tea Party events, which has been an issue for Dewhurst.
Dewhurst is not doing that. Is that smart for Dewhurst to stay out of that? Because I think before we went on the air here, Ross mentioned that, you know, he would go to these events and probably just get beaten up by the other guys and probably not gain a whole lot from it.
Yeah, you know, why elevate everybody else by showing up? If you've got name ID beyond theirs, and why give them an opportunity to throw bricks at you? I mean, you know, it's kind of a rose garden strategy, but this early in the race when people aren't really paying attention and the only things that can happen are probably negative, why play?
Yeah, I guess the only counter to that would be that these Tea Party activists who are putting on these events and they're paying a lot of attention now, they have promised that their memories are going to be just like elephants. They're not going to forget any of this stuff, and they're going to be block walking against people. And one of the Tea Party leaders out of Dallas told me, and, you know, this is where we find out, you know, in these elections, you know, in the last election, the Tea Party, very, very influential. Will they be, you know, in this next one? They have said that, I don't care how much money somebody has, you know, you can't overcome it if we're out in every single neighborhood trying to make sure that everybody knows they ought to vote against you.
Am I right in saying is the primary for this, for the Senate race, is going to be the same time as the presidential primary? Is that right? Okay.
Right. Yeah.
So I think that actually negates some of the Tea Party strength. I mean, you've got the governor of your state running for president, and if he makes it this far to the Texas primary, a gigantic amount of Republicans from all parts of the party are going to come out. And I think that negates kind of the activist, mad Tea Party vote that you saw in other elections, in the last election.
But the Tea Party is sort of the highly activated.
They are, but
though small portion of the electorate that seems to be driving most of the messaging, if not the actual vote.
Right, but I mean, if you say that the Republican Party is broken up into three sections and the Tea Party is one third of it, and the Tea Party are the only people motivated, then they're the majority that come out to the polls. But I think with Governor Perry running for president, all sectors of the Republican Party are going to be motivated, so they're back to one third instead of more of what the vote would be. That's all I'm saying. So you know, the Tea Party candidate.
This would argue for further, need to go to the Tea Party events that Dewhurst has been skipping.
Yeah. That's kind of my argument, sure.
What Ben's trying to say here. Well, you know, the Tea Party is clearly influential ideologically. I mean, they're clearly turning the party that way. It's not at all clear in Texas or, you know, for the most part anywhere else that they're influential as an election force. Can they elect a candidate? They can clearly turn the ideas. They can clearly turn the message. And they're clearly the part of the party that's kind of innervated and, you know, people are paying attention to it and listening to fiscal conservatism, government's too big, all of that kind of stuff. It's not at all clear in any but, you know, two or three legislative elections that the Tea Party was an influential electoral force. So the fact that, you know, these guys may be saying, well, we don't like what you're doing and we're going to knock on doors. Mm-hmm. Are you going to knock on enough doors to outnumber anybody else? And that's just not clear here.
They couldn't change the speaker's race, for example.
Right.
Although it would be interesting to see if they can change the lieutenant governor's replacement campaign if that happens.
Right.
If Dewhurst
in
gets
the Senate. Right.
Yeah. One thing I did talk to, you know, I don't know if they've made this public yet, but I talked to some people at FreedomWorks who said that they had planned on forming one of these super PACs that will probably be not helping or coordinating with Ted Cruz's campaign, but operating parallel in a way that supports them.
Right.
And I don't know if that could make up the difference between him and Dewhurst and McCall. And of course, they could probably, some super PACs would form around them at all, but that could be an interesting.
Oh, and maybe Stephen Colbert will start spending money on Freedom, Ted Cruz's campaign.
FreedomWorks is the national group that's sort of the Dick Armey-led national group that's trying to kind of get in front of the Tea Party movement.
And they were pretty early on the Ted Cruz bandwagon.
Right. Right.
Well, Ted Cruz was, you know, the guy that spoke. I'm going to forget this. Was it right before or right after? I guess it was right after Rick Perry in South Carolina.
At Red State.
Yeah. At Red State. Yeah. Right, at the Tea Party blogger activist convention that the governor announced he was running for president at.
Yeah. I mean, it's clearly the loudest wing of the Republican Party right now. Yeah. Whether it's the biggest, you know, remains to be seen.
And
I'm also curious what your third Republican Party is. You've got
I don't know.
Kind of traditionals, you know.
Where are you going, Phil Pott?
Yeah.
I was really just trying to make a mathematical analogy. Yeah. I don't have, you know, it could be five different parts. I have no idea. I'm just saying that if, you know, the Tea Party is very loud, but if the rest
it could be the Democratic reversed chaos voters that get into the Republican Party.
Right, I mean, but what are you talking about?
See, I don't know what he's talking
Republican,
about.
Republican chaos voters in the Democratic primary last time around switched over and voted for Hillary Clinton.
Okay.
Democrats could do the opposite here, thus being reverse chaos voters.
Right. It would be more effective if there were, like, you know, lots of them.
I was just...
Enough to make a difference.
I was just saying that...
I was just trying to help Ben get a third party.
No,
this has really gone too far.
I was just saying the more Republicans that vote, the more diluted the power would be from the Tea Party. If it's true that not everyone in the Republican Party believes what the Tea Party is pushing.
Well, and if you know the question there, and it's, I think it's kind of an open question, is which way would it dilute? Is the part of the party that hasn't been active more conservative or less conservative than one has been?
That's true.
I mean, conventional wisdom is that it's more moderate, and that a bigger turnout election, particularly a presidential election, if that's still in contest when it comes to Texas, mm-hmm. would be a more moderate Republican primary than an election where, you know, it's just sort of the same old people voting for the same old people.
Yeah, well, and the fact that you've got Perry and Romney who are going to both have so much money to drag this out, you know, that adds to, you know, the possibility that that's what's going to happen, that the presidential primary will still be happening when the Texas primary happens.
Right. One other thing to throw in here while we're talking about the Senate race is that there's a bunch of candidates running for Senate in a Republican primary, and it's, you know, entirely feasible that they'll have a runoff. The runoffs this year are late. They changed the law so that instead of an April runoff, we have a May 22nd runoff. So 11 weeks after the primary, we'll have a runoff.
And a week before school lets out.
So one question is...
It's 11 weeks of things to talk about.
Yeah, one question is, if you have a big turnout primary, are you going to get a big turnout primary runoff, and what's the composition of that going to be? Right. So if someone like Ted Cruz can survive to the second round, mm-hmm. May might be a better electorate for somebody like that than March was.
Yes.
Of course...
I completely agree.
And Ben's fourth third of the electorate will show up for that
one. They'll show up for the runoff. a big probably factor in the race is going to be how McCall or any candidate chooses to campaign, and... will they or will they not take the lessons of Rick Perry's eggheads, which gets into our transition into our second topic.
Nicely done.
Yeah, thanks.
Kind of.
You know, I don't know. If you have to point out why the joke's funny, is it really a joke?
Ben, you want to explain the eggheads?
It wasn't a joke. It was a transition. it wasn't funny.
Ben, you want to try it? Ben, you want to try an explanation of the eggheads?
Well, so it's Sasha Eisenberg, writer's got a book coming out, actually not until September of 2012. Called Victory Lab, where he's going around and he's doing, you know, chapters on different campaigns across the country and what has kind of made them these campaigns that just seem to not be able to lose at all. One of the chapters is on Governor Rick Perry, and being a great capitalist, he decided to the governor. He decided to make that chapter on Rick Perry available this week for 99 cents.
You're not saying the governor is not a great capitalist?
No, of course he is, but I was talking about
Ben Philpott, ladies and gentlemen.
But anyway, so he looked into Dave Carney. Dave Carney and what he has brought to the Perry campaign, the way he has run it. He starts it off with what we actually did some stories on in the 2010 governor's race, the idea that the governor didn't have yard signs.
Right.
And why didn't he have yard signs? And that is just kind of one example of the skepticism that Carney brings into all the different aspects of a political campaign and what you should be doing and what works and what doesn't work. Cool. And Sasha did say, and of course I'm a big baseball fan, so I asked him this, but he did say that this is – Carney is very much taking kind of the Moneyball approach to this, not in that – with that book and the way the Oakland Athletics did their baseball team, they just said, well, wait a minute, why are we paying these players this certain amount? Why are we only looking for players that can hit home runs? Why aren't we looking at other things? And that's what he says Carney has done is, well, why are we using yard signs? What's the effect there? Why are we using mailers? What's the effect there?
Right. He's actually sort of questioning the basic. It's kind of Dave Carney is the mad scientist from New Hampshire and,
yeah. well, and
kind Dave of questioning Carney, everything that they do in a political campaign and saying, does this work? Are we spending this money right? You know.
Dave Carney actually brought in mad scientists. I mean, he brought in academics, right? And had them actually sort of conduct experiments with Rick Perry's campaign.
Yeah, in scientific method. You know, there's a control group and then there's a variable. And, it really is fascinating to look at the way that he, as you're saying, maximized every move with the candidate. If he's going to be over here at this event, if he's going to go to some barbecue joint, you want everybody in that town to talk about the fact that he was there. It's kind of like something I told a news director up in North Texas during the campaign last year. This woman who runs a television station was saying, why can't we? She had just moved here from Florida. And her experiences with Charlie Crist, you know, who, if there's a camera, he's going to run to it and talk. And she's very frustrated about Perry. He won't come in here and do an interview with us. He won't come do the debate, you know, that we want to set up. And I said, well, it's because Rick Perry, at least as far as I can tell, in this election, he'd rather have an oral history. He'd rather people were talking about the fact that he was there and kicked up some dust and moved on, and it was awesome.
Well, right. They actually compared this. They did an empirical look at what things work and what things don't work. And they found, you know, for example, some anecdotal things. They found out that the impact of a candidate actually going to a place was much greater and longer lasting than appearing on satellite or in a TV studio or going to an editorial board at a newspaper. They found that.
And you get better coverage.
They found that going, right. They found that getting out of Austin got you better coverage. Editorial boards didn't help. And in fact, in a Republican primary, hurt. And, you know, they just kind of questioned everything. They also found out yard signs were a waste of money, yep. relatively speaking.
And mailers.
And direct mail to a great extent.
And phone banks.
Right. So all of these things that are sort of the way we've always done them. Apparently, Dave Carney's followed around by a mob of pissed off political consultants all the time. But, you know.
Vendors,
right. But it's hard to argue with success.
So it would be interesting to see that sort of operation go up against the, you know, famed Obama campaign operation.
That's another chapter, isn't it? Obama's campaign is another chapter. And I asked Sasha about the idea of, you know, we're on first name basis. I asked him about the idea of whether or not.
We're glad you have friends. Yeah.
With ebooks.
I stopped him. How about that?
A giggle like Anderson Cooper. Hopefully everybody's seen
subject
that
subject matters
video.
A little better.
But yes, that's right. But no, I asked him about that. The idea of you know, can he? How will this help him with the campaign? Does this mean? Does the way that Carney sets up this system, does that allow him to have a more successful campaign? Considering he's not going to probably raise $500 million like President Obama will raise for this next election, and also how will the experimentation carry forward? And he said, well, the only problem is that that you've got all these experiments for the Perry campaign, but they're all in Texas.
Yeah.
And how do they translate from state to state? You know, it's a lot like, you know, Perry's ahead in Iowa and South Carolina, but he's losing in New Hampshire. So, you know, the experiments are off when you get to other states. Although he does say that he expects they will probably try to do some things in the field and test. And it's just about how quickly you can turn things around. Can you do a test in New Hampshire? That, you know, even if Perry can't win New Hampshire, if Romney holds the lead that he has now, can you do a test in New Hampshire that you can turn the data around and figure something out and use it for one of the other northeastern states later in the primary process? You know, of course, that means he has to stay in the primary process. But right. He said the opportunity's there, but you have to have the time to do it.
Right.
Right. So I haven't actually read the chapter, Ross. You've read the chapter. Are the lessons mostly Texas specific, or is the
they are? I mean, they were based. You know, they let, for example, they let one of the eggheads assign Perry's travel for either 3 or 4 days, and
through a computer program,
right? Through a computer program, just sort of randomized it and said you're going to Amarillo and then you're going to Texarkana. The only two
I
rules.
I think I followed him one of those days.
The only two rules were that they left Houston and Dallas-Fort Worth off the list. For, you know, various reasons, but it made it an easier thing to test if they went to other markets. And this is where they found out that actually showing up in a market was time better spent than putting the governor in a TV studio in Austin and broadcasting to, you know, talking
to doing the via satellite studio interviews. Yeah.
The Adios Mofo interviews,
And did they control for having those interviews be in major markets or being in smaller places? So, I mean,
They did.
If you had him doing satellite interviews in Houston and Dallas, you could compare that to you know, a visit to those places versus a satellite interview with Lubbock or Midland or Corpus.
That's why they randomized it. So they did polling on what happened if you went to town and what kind of coverage you got. So they did content analysis on the coverage. They did polling analysis on the effects of the coverage and on the lasting effect of the coverage, if there was one. And they found that it was much greater than commercials. They were mainly comparing it to commercials.
Mm-hmm. And they even had a control group. I thought that was actually a funny line. They were like, and Abilene received no visits based on the control group.
Abilene got nothing. At the same time, they were testing three different levels of advertising.
Right, the point system.
And, you know, they got what they thought were, you know, pretty interesting results. And I obviously followed through on them and, you know, to some effect. Now, whether, you know, whether that works in New Hampshire, whether it works in South Carolina, that's to be seen. But, it's interesting that we've sort of got these empiricists moving into politics. You know, mm-hmm. this has always been one of those professions that was full of folklore. Mm. Always do this, never do this. Pappy said, you know, and they're questioning all of those things and saying, well, why are we doing mailers? Why are we doing door hangers?
And
why
one thing they did actually figure out, the myth or the legend that is actually true is once you go up on TV, stay up.
Right.
Because they discovered that the impact of a television commercial lasts about a week and then it goes away. So once you are up, you do have to stay up because you have to constantly remind the people.
So that no one says, whatever happened to that guy?
They polled for approval ratings and, you know, what people felt about Governor Perry and all this. And after a week, they just started to go back down to the levels they were before they ran the TV ad, which led then to Governor Perry not going up on TV until 2 weeks before the primary.
Right.
And then staying up wall to wall for those 2 weeks, but they felt they got more bang just doing it. Make sure you were up and doing it for those 2 weeks because the levels remained high.
Hmm. If Perry trusts you, he is willing to let you experiment on him. I think that is one of the themes of the campaign.
Well, one of the marks
back surgery.
Yeah. one of the marks of that campaign has always been that, you know, Perry hires people and lets them run, and you know, I hired you and I'm trusting you to do this. Don't screw it up, and you know. So far, so good, right? I mean, it's an unusual thing in a campaign. Often candidates are, you know, paranoid micromanagers. You know, it's their reputation.
Well,
you know, you're talking about the person that they
shave.
Why am I
thinking of Bill White?
You can think of anybody you want. I mean, you can
reportedly
name almost anybody
that
in politics.
Newt Gingrich's problem when he lost all the Perry people.
Yeah.
Well, one of them. Other than he also will like to vacation.
Well, maybe it's one of the, you know, signs of just a successful politician. They don't take the way the campaign is run personally. You might remember last year when Paul Burka, I think, got banned by Kay Bailey Hutchison's campaign because he had said her campaign is awful, which it was.
Banned from a debate.
Which he was banned from a debate. He was going to be a moderator, I think, at the debate at UNT.
It was a KERA's debate.
Yeah, he got you know, they had a fit and said, you know, we don't want him on the panel. And all he had said was that her campaign needed to have, you know, EMS crew on standby outside because he was saying that it was on life support, that the campaign was bad. She takes it personally if you criticize the campaign or want to change a campaign or have ideas about how the campaign should be run. Sounds like Perry doesn't do that. He says, you know, what's the best way to do this? And he finds people to pick it apart.
But with the exception of that campaign, you'd have to call her a successful politician.
Right.
She's never lost before that. I mean, you know, they're paranoid people all over politics. Go read Primary Colors, which is sort of a Romana Clef about it was a book.
But there is a movie.
It's a Romana Clef about Bill Clinton, and it's just, you know, it's clearly a, you know, crazy megalomaniac, you know, on some level. You know, they're just, you know, that's the way politicians are.
Can we talk about a campaign that probably is not featured in the book, and that's Ron Paul's campaign.
Why is Ron Paul not featured?
he's really not featured anywhere, which has become – it's actually – there's probably more coverage about why Ron Paul isn't covered than there is about Ron Paul.
The Daily Show bit about that was pretty good.
The Daily Show led everybody else. The Daily Show had their why is no one talking about Ron Paul on Monday night after the Iowa straw poll.
Yeah.
Tuesday morning, CNN and Fox were wall to wall. Why aren't people talking about Ron Paul? We don't understand this. Thank you, John Stewart, for pointing this out to
watch the Daily Show.
It makes no sense.
Well, Paul was interesting. I talked to him a few weeks ago and asked him why he wasn't getting more oxygen here. And, you know, and one of the questions I asked him was, you know, a lot of these guys, Perry included, are stealing your ideas. You know, it's sort of like, you know, peanuts in his Coke before it was cool. You know, Ron Paul was out there talking about the Federal Reserve, limited government, balanced budgets, federalism, all of that stuff, you know, 15 years ago.
Yeah.
And now a lot of candidates are sort of co-opting a lot of those ideas. Ron Paul is a really interesting cat. I mean, the people that have campaigned for him for years have had that Tea Party quality of being really, really energetic people, you know. He has a knack for getting young people in the campaign, just, you know, sort of volunteering and kind of throwing themselves on mm-hmm. the wheel and going after it. But he's always been the candidate who was influential ideologically, but relatively a small force mm-hmm. electorally. He sets up in this race as, you know, if he doesn't catch fire and doesn't become a front runner, he sets up really well as a spoiler, because he's going to attract votes from both sides of the Republican Party.
Well, all three parts.
All four thirds of it.
It's become a cliche to say that Rick Perry was Tea Party before Tea Party was cool, but Ron Paul was Tea Party before, you know,
before the Tea Party was.
Yeah,
right.
He was Tea Party back before the original Boston one.
Right?
Yeah.
Well, a lot of what the Tea Party's talking about, you know, comes from the libertarian wing of the Republican Party. It comes from, you know, Barry Goldwater and the mm-hmm. libertarians and all of that stuff. And that's where Ron Paul lives, you know. The whole idea of smaller, limited government really started, you know, or its modern incarnation really started over there. Ron Paul's been there for a while, and some of those ideas have caught on. You know, this used to be, another question that, you know, he often gets asked, I asked him, is, you know, you've been on the fringe for so long, and the fringe has moved toward you. You know, the center has moved, you know, what used to be considered fringe or odd or weird has now become, you know, part of the main body of the Republican Party. I think he's getting crowded.
Do you think that he's really crowded, or do you think, because you say the center's moved toward him, but it goes back to what we were talking about before, is it really bigger or is it just louder? Because of the internet, because of talk radio and everything else?
Well, I think the center's moved because, you know, you've got the candidates who are, you know, everybody's talking about smaller government.
Yeah.
It's not just one wing of the Republican Party that's doing it. And that's what I mean, is that they've moved the sort of the main part of the Republican Party into some of these ideas. Not all of them, you know. We're not having a gold standard argument yet. But
yet.
Well, but we could.
That's one thing that Gawker.com floated, which is the New York hipster blog,
yeah.
right. widely read here in Austin, at least.
At Rebound of Hipster, yeah. right. Yeah.
Uh-huh. They did this post on why they think that Ron Paul isn't getting covered, and one of them is just that his ideas are sort of a little bit too complicated and nuanced, so rather than spend ink and airtime trying to explain why he thinks a gold standard is a good thing to say, they just say, oh, gold standard's kooky, let's move on and cover someone else who we can understand.
Right.
Well, and is it also a function of the fact that, unlike these other candidates, he's run for president before, and so everybody is not viewing him as the shiny new toy. They're looking at Rick Perry like that. They're looking at Bachman like that. And, you know, even though Romney's run once, it wasn't twice. So, I mean, he doesn't have as much dust on him.
But they can't argue that Ron Paul is not polling well enough to be considered. I mean,
right.
Well,
I think there's something.
Well, right?
I think there's something to that. Everybody else was sort of newsy,
yeah.
right? Because they're new,
right?
And but we're in this cycle. You know, whether it was started by the Daily Show, you know, something has to kick it off, right? But we're in this cycle of reconsideration of, you know, so what about Ron Paul? And people are going to take a look at him in that context. And the question in all of these things. I mean, this is, you know, simple. You know, conceptually simple. It's hard to make it happen if you're a candidate. Yeah. If you can get everybody to look at you and judge you against the other candidate, and you have a fair shot at least the voters hearing about you, then you have a fair shot at the vote.
Well, so this Gallup poll may really help. I mean, it helps keep him.
What Gallup poll?
The Gallup poll that took the top four, I guess, Republican candidates and put them head-to-head against President Obama. Obama loses to Romney, ties Rick Perry, and then beats Bachman by 3 points and Paul by 2 points.
They were all within the margin of error. Neck and neck.
Right.
But I think, you know, maybe what it speaks to more, and you know, Ben mentioned this earlier, that Gallup poll is kind of eh, and they said so in their release.
Yeah, it's not a good predictor.
It is a technical term, but when you look at it and you see Obama against all these people, Ron Paul included, he does about the same against all of them. I think it probably speaks more to how people feel about Obama than any of these Republicans. They're looking to – it might as well have been a comparison to generic Republican, because people are still wide open about who they might support.
But as long as Paul's in that, and it doesn't – you know, it can be irritating if you're a member of the press, but it doesn't hurt to have to be the candidate whose supporters are most likely to call reporters and say, why aren't you covering my candidate?
Right.
I mean, that's effective, and that's the campaign that's most likely to do that. Whether the campaign's doing it or whether supporters or freelancing doesn't really matter. If you don't cover Paul at the same level that they think you should be covering Paul, you're likely to hear about it. And I think that's probably, you know, that spurs some coverage.
Well, all that said, and with apologies to Deborah Medina, who has also provided a celebrity intro for us, Ron Paul's chances of winning a general election are probably less than some of the other candidates.
Well, he's got to get it out of a primary first.
Right.
Well, but that he can throw that Gallup poll up now. He can say, look, I got a better chance of beating Obama than
I mean, if the center of the Republican Party has moved towards him, that doesn't mean that he can still get the majority of the country. I think that might be tough for him because he's been out on the fringe for so long, and he's viewed as a fringe candidate by many people.
Well, and, you know, they're
polls to the contrary.
The sort of the business plan in the Paul campaign doesn't seem to include the same sort of marketing that the business plans for the Perrys and the Bachmans and the Romneys have. Yeah. I mean, you know, this is, you know, it's a 18-month to 24-month entrepreneurial business that you're running if you're running a campaign. And it has to have a marketing thing that's something other than disdain for what's happening, right? And the Paul campaign has to get out in front of this thing and promote their guy in the same way that the other campaigns are.
Well, and speaking of Deborah Medina, she did this for us, but since you are here, Scott, we won't make you. But usually we have the celebrity introducer also give us an outro, something along the lines of, if you have questions or comments about the podcast, then you can email them to podcasts@texastribune.org. That having been said,
I'll say people should do that.
Very good.
How about that?
Thank you. Right. And on that note, on behalf of Ross, Ben, Scott, and our producer, Todd, this has been Reeve Hamilton with the Tribcast. Thanks for listening.
Don't tweet that.